Welcome, everyone, to All About Windows Phone Insight Podcast. This is 119, recording this on Wednesday, the 26th of November, 2014. I'm Steve Litchfield, and Rafe Blanford is with me, as always.
Hello, everybody.
And we do have just a slightly smaller number of stories, but some of them could run on, Rafe, especially the last one, when we discuss the best Windows phone in the world. Do my Jeremy Clarkson there and failing.
I think people who listen to this podcast regularly will know I don't really have any trouble in talking at length on pretty much any subject, so I'm pretty sure we'll get to our usual about 35-minute length. And there's a few small topics we can bring up as well and talk about some of the apps we've been using recently. But I know Steve has been cursed recently by hearing buzzing while he's been recharging his phone. I think that was the first topic you wanted to talk about this week, but it turns out there's actually not something going wrong, or, well, not anything more wrong with your ears, I should probably say, Steve.
Yeah, well, my ears probably didn't take kindly to a Larry Miller high-volume rock concert last Saturday night. But apart from that, the other reason for the buzzing was the fact that essentially Qi charging on the 830, Lumia 830, had a kind of tick, tick, tick about three or four times a second. It was really bizarre. I thought, is the device faulty? So I asked around. Other people with 830s reported the same thing. Then people with 930s started saying, hang on a minute, I hear the tick ticking as well. I then Googled Qi charging tick, tick, ticking noise and found lots of people on all sorts of different platforms, all sorts of different devices, all hearing the same thing. And once you've heard it once, it's only a matter of, with any device and any charging pad, just getting your ear close enough that you can hear the noise. Now, the crucial thing, of course, is whether it's actually annoying. On the Lumia 830, with the fairly brittle construction, you know, metal, it's quite thin, it's this quite compact, I find the ticking noise is loud enough to be heard unless I've got music on. The 930 is quieter, and on things devices like the 1020 with its charging shell and the 920, it's quiet enough that you really have to get your ear right next to the pad, so it's not a problem. But what I found out after a little bit of putting my physicist hat on is that within part of the protocol that actually controls how much charge is being pulsed up through the electromagnetic coils, but there's what's called backscatter modulation, whereby the receiving device physically changes the load, modulates the load it's placing on the charging pad. And by modulating this load in a particular way, it can send signals back to the pad, actual digital data signals, via this analog carrier, if you like, telling it to give me more power, less power, stop charging, etc., etc. And these protocol pulses, these bits of data, get sent, guess what, every 250 milliseconds, i.e. every quarter of a second. So what you're hearing is the physical manifestation of the load changing, subtly changing, as the charge is kind of induced from the pad to the device, and the device kind of answering back by changing the resistance on that coil. So it's kind of complicated, but the bottom line is that the devices are working as advertised. On some devices with particular components, particular resistors, particular capacitors, particular switching circuits, maybe the effect is more audible than others, as you know, as perhaps as components can expand, contract, change state. I don't think it's a problem on reflection. I've learned to live with it on the 830, and certainly all my other devices are quieter. But it's just an interesting phenomenon. I hadn't, to my knowledge, I didn't think anyone else anywhere on the internet has actually put two and two together yet. So I was quite glad to be the one the Sherlock Holmes who solved the mystery.
It's interesting, isn't it, this one, because obviously Qi wireless charging has been around for a while. And you're right, I haven't actually seen commentary about this. And having had Steve sort of mention this a couple of times, I got some pretty funny looks as I was putting my ear down next to my phone while the Qi charging pad was on, and I couldn't hear it. Now, I actually have very poor hearing, relatively speaking, and I even tried recording it and sort of seeing if I could catch anything, but I wasn't able to. I listened back to your audio sample, Stephen. Obviously, it is there, but it's interesting. I wonder whether the hearing range or the level is something that maybe you have better hearing than it seems, and listening to all that rock music has maybe not damaged your hearing as much as it has mine. It's kind of an interesting one. As you say, this is the signal going back to pass data back and forth. The reason it does this actually is because obviously it controls how much power is coming out of the Qi charging pad. And so when the phone gets placed down on the pad, there's actually what's going on is there's a signal being sent saying essentially boost the power and start charging me. And when it gets to 100%, actually it'll be at various different levels, you'll get different signals. It'll switch over to trickle charging, and if it's removed altogether, obviously it switches off. But there's actually within the spec some capability for sending these messages back and forth, and obviously changing the level at which it's being charged. As I understand it, in sort of later version of the spec, extra functionality is being added, and it's actually a pretty clever way of doing it when you think about it, because there is obviously no physical connection between the phone and the charging pad, and particularly if it's, you know, not a pad, it's built into something else, it's a big deal. Now, there is a limit to the amount of communication that you can do. You might be wondering about Nokia's new charging pad, which actually has quite a lot of new functionality. It's able to kind of breathe, for example, when your phone needs charging, it can flash on alerts and notifications. But that's actually achieved by having a Bluetooth low energy connection in it, yes, rather than the sort of this background charging. So just a note, it's when we talk about it communicating back and forth, it's pretty simple stuff, and it's really around the charging. And you'll find that actually something similar happens on most charging solutions. There's a modulation of the current, the signal being passed back and forth in order to kind of control what level it comes at. And just sort of by way of kind of incidental information, we've talked in the past about the quick charge implementation. This is something that Qualcomm's been promoting, and most of the current Windows phone devices have quick charge 1.0, which basically allows quicker charging via the micro USB port than before. There's actually some support coming in for quick charge 2.0 now in certain chipsets. I believe one of the first Windows phones to get this is the HTC One M8 Windows Phone Edition. You have to have a specific charger to go with, because actually there's obviously then intelligence in the charger as well to make it charge even faster. And this quick charge can potentially get you up to sort of 75% battery level in about 40 minutes. So about double the speed of current charging. The exact specs vary depending on how it's implemented. And if you want to go and read about it, there's a whole bunch of information on the Qualcomm site. It's actually something that's in a couple of tablets. The Lumia 2520 is an example of that. And I suspect it's something we'll see on more phones next year, especially as the kind of technology matures a bit and the necessary chips to go in the charger come down in cost. And, you know, they can do it without really adding much cost to the bill of materials for the charger and obviously the phone itself. So when you think about these charging solutions, it's not quite as simple as sticking it in the wall and having energy coming out. There's actually a certain amount of back and forth, as rather ably demonstrated by the clicks that Steve's been hearing on the Qi charging. You know, there's a good reason for them. Hopefully they're not too distracting for people. I guess the fact that it's gone unnoticed so long probably suggests that it hasn't really been a big deal. I haven't seen people complaining about it. But it was interesting, you know, to speculate, as you did, Steve, that the 830 may be particularly susceptible to it because of the way it's built. And I'd agree, you know, it does feel like there's a lot less tolerances on the materials. I mean, I love the fact it's a really thin device, and it perhaps, you know, that's one of the downsides of, you know, as devices get thinner, this sort of thing is going to probably become a more common occurrence.
Yeah, in actual fact, I think most of the noise is coming from the pad itself, but the 830 being quite thin actually tends to transmit those sounds audibly through the materials, but more than perhaps some of the thicker and denser phones. I think that's partly where the problem lies. But this quick charge thing you mentioned, that's also interesting. The early research I saw on the web tended to think, well, the quick charging of phone will actually, your phone battery will actually damage it to some degree. In other words, it's more detrimental to the battery's health than charging at a traditional speed. Since then, we've seen other studies come out saying, no, there's no long-term detrimental effect whatsoever. So I think the jury's still out there. We've only had quick charging for a few months, Ray, so I suspect it'll take another 6 months or so before we have real user accounts of, well, I've been quick charging my device X for the last 6 months, and now the battery's shot or the battery's fine.
That's right. I mean, we're referring to Quick Charge 2.0 here, which is actually the first implementation that feels much quicker than what we've had before. As I say, we've had Quick Charge 1.0 in the current generation for a while, but that's really about optimizing, you know, the amount of charge coming through at given times, because basically the thing is you can put more energy in between the sort of 0 and 80% level. And once you get to the last 20% of the battery, it kind of makes sense to reduce the charging rate to sort of trickle charge. And that's actually to do again with protecting the battery. But you're right, there's been various studies around this. I mean, battery technology has come on so far since we first started writing about mobile devices. There really isn't a need to kind of train the battery. Well, not to the extent there used to be. I think it's still a good recommendation to let your phone run down to sort of 0% or 10% at least every month or so. But in day-to-day usage, you don't really need to worry about kind of battery memory or draining or things like that. I suspect they'll be keeping a very close eye on this for quick charging. But it may be one of the reasons it's been around for a while, and certainly some of the current chipsets are capable of supporting it. It won't necessarily be turned on. And as I said, it does require both support within the hardware of the phone and the hardware of the charger itself. But as you say, yeah, we'll probably get more information, more reports on that. And as I say, I think we'll it's kind of a hard thing to sell. I think it's not something you can talk about really in a phone shop, but I do expect it to be a technology we see a lot more of in 2015.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, on iOS, very good for taking panoramas, I believe. I've seen some wonderful examples. On Android, you have Photosphere, Google's system, where you just wave your Nexus around or whatever, and you can capture high-resolution panoramas in vertically as well as horizontally all around you. On Windows Phone, we don't really have very much. We do have Photosynth. I just wanted to highlight the fact that it's had an update, and now, Rafe, the resolution it supports has gone from abominable to not quite so bad. So it has had an update. If you go to settings in Photosynth, you now get a choice of, let's wait for it, capture resolution can now be standard. Ooh. Or that's about a megapixel, or higher, which is about 1.5 to 2 megapixels. So it really is pretty darn low. Obviously, it depends how many photographs you stitch together. And if you stitch, I don't know, 20 or 30 together, then you will get something that ends up at about 5 to 8 megapixels. But compared to the iPhone and Android competition, I do somehow think that Microsoft is really hedging its bets downwards here. And I think they could do better with Photosynth.
Yeah, I mean, Photosynth in a way is a sort of technology that was really developed for other uses, and it's been shoehorned onto mobile. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing, because it does kind of create these 3D photos, and actually kind of the intention was to be able to quickly capture kind of 3D panoramas, but with a sort of sense of depth more to them and be able to move around them. And it is, to be fair, Photosynth photos aren't really quite the same as just a flat panorama. But of course, there are a couple of panorama tools available, including Lumia Panorama. And yes, I would agree, they definitely fall down compared to what's available on Android devices and iPhone, which tend to have the sweep type camera functionality that you get on, you know, standalone cameras. And it seems surprising that we haven't seen Lumia get that kind of functionality, given that imaging has always been such a strong point. And it would certainly seem, in terms of the hardware support, it's there and able to do it, because if you can do it on the Android devices and on the iPhone, there isn't really any reason in terms of hardware requirements that you can't do it on the Lumia devices. I mean, the only thing might be the speed of sort of the camera itself. And as we've talked about before, Nokia and now Microsoft does tend to emphasize quality over the speed of the camera. That's something actually you're going to see a bit of an improvement with Lumia camera. It's going to be much harder to see a difference between kind of the leading cameras in terms of performance, or at least I think that'll be a big improvement for Lumia. It does kind of say, make me wonder why we haven't seen more of this. I suppose it comes down to the fact that panoramas aren't the most natural thing to capture, and so they've decided to, you know, put their investment and their money elsewhere. And again, it's something we've talked about this before with photos. You actually have to choose to take a panorama, and that's a bit more of an involved decision. It's not that kind of instant snap that you get. But I do really like the kind of the sweet panorama that you get on both the iPhone and Android devices. On the Android devices, I think it's still a customization that you get from most of the device manufacturers. But as you say, there is the Google Sphere app. So yes, it's a good one. But I guess good news that Photosynth is a slightly higher resolution, but you do have to work quite hard to get something decent out of it. As I say, I'd give Photosynth a pass here, because actually it's not quite competing with the panorama apps. It's creating these synths, as Microsoft calls them. And it's still an impressive piece of technology for a mobile device.
Yeah, I think if I remember rightly, when Photosynth started, the idea was not just for, you know, individual users to produce 2D panoramas, or even 3D panoramas, if you like, including the vertical. The idea was to take these individually user-stitched photographs, and then build them from lots of other users into this hole whereby you could have a virtual tour around a particular landmark or a particular place, all built up from what users had shot with their Photosynth application.
Right. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, some of that's gone away, obviously, with the mobile version. There's obviously still the sharing component to it. But it was something that came out of the Microsoft Research Labs. And so it's one of those products that's actually, I think, more technology cool than actually useful to consumers. I guess you could say that about an awful lot of the imaging apps, come to think of it, that, you know, it's kind of fun for social sharing and fun for a quick go and sort of demonstrating the advantages of having a computer attached to your camera. And I guess it's all this computational imagery or computational photography, which we're hearing so much about. And when it works, it's absolutely fantastic. But I sort of maintain that you really need to integrate it into just the standard capture process, which is why we're really looking forward to the Lumia camera so much, because what it does with rich captures, it's just capturing as you would normally and then adding some very clever functionality to it. You know, compared to all the special modes you tend to get on other cameras, or things like CinemaGraph or Refocus on the Lumia devices.
Yeah. And talking of Lumia camera, I'm guessing you mean Lumia camera, not the old Lumia camera, which is different from the Nokia camera, and then depends on which platform you're on, and because the real Lumia camera hasn't arrived yet. And if all that sounds incredibly confusing, it's because it is. I think what Microsoft are aiming at is that there will just be one camera application. It will be called Lumia camera, but they're having to juggle so many balls in the air in terms of keeping the devices on Cyan happy, the devices currently on Denim happy, like the 830, all the people on the developer preview, and having to do testing on all these different devices and roll it out in a seamless over-the-air update way. It can't be easy for them. In the meantime, I guess just saying Lumia camera means nothing, because there was an update today, Rafe.
There was,
a Lumia camera on my 1020 and the older devices, which did absolutely nothing as far as I could see, and it certainly didn't bring any new functionality. And on my 830, which is the device running Denim, which I would expect to see the new Lumia camera, in quotes, functionality, I didn't have the update, so it's all rather strange. We will keep on top of it, and you regular watchers, listeners and readers can rest assured that the moment the real Lumia camera enters the room and within its dinner jacket, I shall pounce on it and give it the works.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, really, there's the kind of the standard Windows Phone camera app that you see relatively rarely now. You actually get it on the non-Lumia devices. And in certain markets, you'll also see it on Lumia devices if they haven't preloaded Lumia Camera Classic. And Lumia Camera Classic, I believe, is the one you tend to get on the mid-tier and the lower-end devices. And then Lumia Camera is the kind of the real thing. And that's the one we're expecting to be updated in due course. And as Steve says, it hasn't happened yet. Just to complicate things, there was a Lumia camera beta or a Nokia camera beta. That's, as far as I'm aware, has now ended, and it's sort of switched over to the release version. But I wouldn't be too surprised to see that reappear at some point. But yes, all these relative different camera versions, probably the best thing is just to keep an eye on the front page of All About Windows Phone. And Steve will be reporting in detail when it arrives, and we'll be able to, and we'll talk about it more on the podcast as well. I feel that we keep saying it's coming soon, but it really is coming soon. My understanding is that it will arrive in December, and hopefully that means before Christmas.
Yeah, and in anticipation of that, in addition to the 1520, which I've got here, and the 830, I've also managed to procure a long-term loan 930 as well from Nokia. So I now have the full range of devices. So whatever gets released, I can give it the full treat.
Excellent. So. Yeah, because we're going to get 4K mode on the 930 and the 1520, but not on the 830, because that's a Snapdragon 400, not a Snapdragon 800. So I hope you're keeping up, everybody. All the all the different things, and of course, there are different camera modules as well. So it's just, it's really quite straightforward, honest. You press the camera button and you take a picture, and that's probably all you really need to worry about.
Well, actually, no, because you do a long press of the shutter get button, then you take a short snatch of video from which take frames. That is actually one of the bits I'm most looking forward to. So sorry to correct you, Rafe, but there will be full coverage of this on the site.
Absolutely right. That's the 4K video mode, which you can then extract kind of still frames from. Yeah. And you're right. That's one of the things that is really clever use of existing physical hardware. And also the performance improvements that I referred to earlier in terms of startup time and shot-to-shot time. That's something that's also coming with this Lumia camera update the proper one, not the minor one.
And I did notice that people have been talking for about a year or so with the Galaxy Note range, which can shoot 4K video. And the idea being is that you can you literally take a video of your family doing something, then you go back later on, frame by frame, and extract 8 megapixel stills. And the idea is there, and it works, but you have to go through a very fiddly Samsung video player stroke editor mode, and it's all rather quirky and takes a lot of time. I think Nokia's implementation looks to be much better and much smoother, and you literally just long press the shutter button, and as you say, it takes whatever it is, however long you want, 3 or 4 seconds of video, 10 seconds, and then it automatically shows you with an easy-to-use interface on the screen which bits do you want, which frames do you want, and you can quickly select them and quickly save them. So I think Nokia hopefully have learned from some of the quirks in the Android implementations, and Nokia's camera software, not for the first time, will end up being more intuitive than the competition's.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I tried this out a while ago when the 830 launched, and they were showing it off on the 930 and the 1520 as well. It's kind of, you scrabble through it as if it was an audio or a video feed, and you can pick out the frame that you want, and it works really well. I think that's one of the things that the imaging team has done really well, is to refine the interfaces. And I remember when the new camera app launched with the kind of the push out and then being able to access all the settings, that this is the next thing on from that. And actually something similar happens for what is effectively an HDR mode. Nokia don't quite refer to it as that, or didn't, rather you should really be calling them Microsoft now. And that's where you basically are combining photos captured at 3 different exposures, and there's just a simple slider, and you can move back and forth along it and dictate sort of the pattern and the combination that comes in. You know, very clever stuff is happening real time on the screen. The reason that's good is most of the HDR modes on existing camera phones are to a set level. It all happens automatically, and then a picture comes out at the end. What's nice about this is it's just like kind of the smart reframing. You can actually go back and edit it at any time you like, and so you can have one version that maybe emphasizes the dark and maybe one that's lighter, and go between those two extremes. And actually something very similar happens for the flash and non-flash scenario. It's kind of just a very simple, you scroll through it with a scroll bar, just move it with your finger, and you can choose exactly which level you want your photo at. So it really is the best implementation I've seen on a camera phone, when you bear in mind that it needs to be something that's easier for people to use without really thinking about it. You know, if you're looking to do the full thing, you're going to be capturing 3 different photos at 3 different exposure levels anyway, and flash, non-flash, and combining them yourself on a PC. This is really aimed at doing it on the device as quickly and as easily as possible.
Yeah, it's just kind of a shame that the Lumia 1020's innards aren't quite up to running this new software, because it actually would have been really handy to have had the facility of the dynamic flash working with the Xenon flash. So you had the option of a full white-out, massive, brilliantly white-lit Xenon shot and the complete ambient shot, and mixing those rather than relying on an LED flash shot and the ambient. So it's kind of one disappointment, but who knows? Maybe I'll get Xenon back in 2015.
Well, keep your fingers crossed, Steve. You never know. I mean, I suspect that would have been extra work to kind of work out how to do that, because it's effectively yet another kind of lighting or flash level. And as you say, the 1020, it's really about the uniqueness of both the camera hardware, in terms of, you know, the 42 megapixel camera has a totally different kind of camera stack compared to the other Lumia devices. And it also is obviously on the whole older software. It's the Snapdragon S4, which is sort of equivalent to the Snapdragon 400, but not really, because it's one generation back. But we won't get into a technical discussion there.
Yeah. Okay. Staying with hardware, I did do a roundup of coverage around the internet by some of the major tech sites of Microsoft Band, Microsoft's new wearable. And the reason I had to round up other people's is because, of course, it's only been released in the USA, and even then only in very, very limited numbers. So we had absolutely zero chance to get hands on, Rafe, and I don't think we will until maybe even version 2 of the Band sometime next year. But the proposition I've got for you is, rather than talk about something you haven't had hands on, is the fact that it's all tied in with this Microsoft Health, which is, unlike the Band itself, Microsoft Health seems to have got a very, very good press, and it seems to be that Microsoft have actually got the inertia and the size. They could actually pull off the all-consuming fitness environment that all the other platforms, all the other wearables all feed into. And I think Microsoft Health is the bigger story rather than the Band itself.
Yeah, absolutely, Steve. I agree with you. Health is actually the much more important thing here. Microsoft Band, don't get me wrong, it's interesting, but it kind of feels like a prototype product. And it's been interesting reading some of the reviews, including the things you referred to, that say it's not very comfortable to wear. There's a few improvements to be made. And I was listening to the Mobile Tech Roundup podcast hosted by our friends Matt Miller and Kevin Tofel. And, you know, they actually were both keen on the Microsoft Band and had gone out and bought one. Even they were sort of saying, yeah, there's still work to be done. It does feel like that. But you look at Microsoft Health, actually it sort of ties back into Microsoft Health Vault, which is something that's been going on for a long time. Microsoft thinking quite carefully about the digital storage of health records. Microsoft Health, bit more of a consumer play and being able to tie in with various wearables and various fitness and tracking related services. But the big thing is, of course, it's being cross-platform. And you can, with the new Microsoft, with Satya Nadella's vision about delivering services and being cross-platform, being mobile and cloud first, it feels like there's less baggage attached to it. I mean, don't get me wrong, Microsoft wants to make money out of it just as Apple and Google do, but Microsoft are the first to say, actually, we don't care, we want it to be cross-platform, we're not just restricting this to Windows Phone, which they have to do given that Windows Phone is very firmly in third place. But it feels a bit more compelling than the Google or the Apple alternative. It'll be interesting to see. They are going to face an uphill struggle simply because Google and Apple are much bigger in terms of the number of people they'll be able to get initially. But I wonder whether the Microsoft Health thing will actually be more successful about doing the thing that's going to be the real value, which is tying into kind of the health infrastructure. And I mean things like doctors and hospitals and that whole kind of healthcare enterprise level. It's a bit early to judge this, but it's nice to see that Microsoft's taking the right approach, and they're also partnering with as many people as possible to get the data in. We'll have to wait and see. I mean, I haven't had a chance really to play with this in any detail. And Microsoft Health, at least initially, with US only, and it's one of those things where you actually have to look a few steps ahead and see what's coming. And I think that's where you're right, Steve. There's a lot of potential there. And quite possibly it's Microsoft in a good position to take advantage of the fact that almost by their very nature, Apple and Google's efforts are tied to their own platforms. And it's difficult to see that changing. I mean, it is also things beyond that. Some of the thinking behind Microsoft Health is you're trying to provide insight into your broader well-being. It's hard to see how that will go. I mean, I've seen a couple of predictions recently that saying this kind of aggregated health data could become really important in solving and making predictions about various health-related topics.
Yeah.
Could it potentially curing a disease is perhaps going a bit far, but if you start thinking about the implications of having access to this data in anonymized ways and sort of big data, people are going to start to get scared, because obviously their health and their medical data is something that's very sensitive and there has to be good security and good privacy around it. But at the same time, these kind of systems have the potential to collect the amount of data that could be very interesting to start being able to draw conclusions. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if we do see medical breakthroughs as a result of this. I'm not saying it will necessarily be Microsoft Health, but all of these platforms have a great deal of potential. And it's just, it almost happenstance in some ways, or the good fortune of Microsoft, that they're going cross-platform from the beginning. They've already got this Microsoft Health Vault kind of system. And to be fair, Google has something similar as well. But they're starting to think in an enterprise way already, probably reflecting the nature of Microsoft as a company itself, providing big services on the back end for enterprise and that kind of big data, the cloud approach. Well worth watching, because there's an enormous amount of value in there. You just need to look at the healthcare sector to realize just how much money is in there. Just as maybe you can talk about with wearables more generally, there is this whole interesting personal consumer stuff, but actually when you get into healthcare specifically, that's probably where a lot of the value for wearables is going to come in the next few years.
Yeah, I've been trying a fair few wearables in my phone show, an Android Beat, with those hats on, so people can follow my usual links and they can find my reviews of the various smartwatches. But suffice it to say, I think I'm looking forward to Microsoft Band Gen 2 and Microsoft Health both being rolled out sort of in spring 2015. I think that's when certainly Rafe and I will certainly get our hands on and get some real experience with the system. Moving on to our last topic of the podcast. Now, I was determined to work out, after facing a barrage of phones on my desk, work out which was the best. And you know how it is. I put my SIM in one, I try it for a day, then I think, well, I'll try the other one. The grass is always greener somewhere else. And I was switching backwards and forwards. I thought, this is ridiculous. I've got to have some systematic way of working out which is the best Windows phone in the world. And I thought our readers and listeners might also appreciate coming along for the ride. So I did a table. Which I should say that although you can't read the tables and all about Windows Phone on a Windows Phone because of the dynamic site rendering that Ray very cleverly does for most content, but it doesn't work for tables. But I did do a bitmap version of the table, so hopefully people on Windows Phones could have brought it up as an image on the screen and then zoomed in and out and panned around, so hopefully everyone was included. The surprise for me, Ray, actually, is that if you look at the table yourself on the screen now, the Lumia 1520, not surprisingly, is it comes out on top because it has every feature, but it's also twice the size of some of the other phones. The interesting thing is that once you, for example, eliminate the 1520 as perhaps being too big to recommend to everyone, you start then thinking, okay, well, the Lumia 1020, the 930 and the 830 are probably less than second equal, but the 830 has got the less powerful chipset and only 1 gig of RAM. So you have to start wondering whether that'll start falling behind as application updates come out, as Windows 10 appears. The Lumia 1020, no more powerful and even older chipset, has the 2 gig of RAM, but you have to feel it's going to run out of steam at some point in 2015. Which leaves, it's much to my surprise, the Lumia 930 as the overall winner. It's not too big to recommend, and it has the up-to-date chipset and the 2 gig of RAM and a pretty decent camera. It's got the 4K recordings we just discussed earlier, and it's got the Qi charging, and it's got a reasonably large battery. It's got a loudspeaker, and it's got a 5-inch really nice AMOLED screen at 1080p. So even though the 930 is a device I haven't really majored on over the last 4 or 5 months, I had to feel that overall it became the pick of my overall winner, and that's one of the reasons why I got it back in, just to give it a second chance. And I'm wondering whether you agree with my winner.
Well, it's interesting because I was looking at this table and sort of going, well, there's a few where I would sort of say it's not quite a simple question of yes or no. And I think a good example of that is the camera, where, for example, the M8 gets marked down. I think for certain people, that camera is actually going to be fine because of the speed. But I'll give you that one. And I'd have actually said the 830 is really good camera for its class. And of course, the other thing is you look at something like cost, and I think you have to give the advantage to the 830 there.
I specifically excluded value for money. That's coming in part two of the feature next week, Ray.
Yes, I know that. And I wanted to give a shout out for that. But there was also a few things like on the M8, for example, it does have a very big battery, and it also has the dot view case, which isn't quite equivalent to glance screen, but it sort of it gets there, and you noted it quite rightly in the table. The thing about the 930 that has put me off it is the lack of glance screen, because that's a big deal for me, and that gives you a clue. All of these categories are rated equal, and of course Steve, being the camera person, has included one for both still camera and video camera. I would probably always just have an overall camera rating, because, well, I like taking photos and videos. It's probably not the equal of two, and actually I really don't care that much about the process and the RAM, as long as it feels snappy, and I have a great deal of difficulty day to day in telling the difference between the various devices. You can actually, if you compare them side by side, and I will say, having been using the 830 for a while, I can actually just feel a bit of a difference. I'd have to switch back to the 930 to be sure about it. But as I say, all of these categories are treated equally. So I was kind of surprised as well, Steve, to see the 930 come out on top. I think we've probably been a bit unkind about it on the podcast, just because we're so used to the glance screen. If you look at any other element of it, it really is a very, very strong device. And I think it's going to get stronger with some of the software updates coming. Its actual camera functionality will be a step ahead of everything else, notably over something like the 1020. So at the moment, I noticed that you rated the 1020, the 1520, the 930 and the 830 all as having kind of good video cameras, but you gave the still camera one to the 1020. I'm assuming that's both the size of the sensor and internal flash. Yeah. I would say once the new camera software arrives, maybe you'd have to switch that over to the 1520 and 930, big debate in itself. But then equally, you can look at the 830 and some of the other devices that, like the M8, that have micro SD, and similarly for the Samsung device. And actually, I think that's a real advantage, because if you're, you know, getting a big SD card, you can get a 64 gigabyte that has excellent performance and put that in, and that will put any of the other devices to shame. And I would say now about 90% of the third-party applications can be installed to a memory card, and those that you can't, you can just switch the setting back while you're installed and then switch it back again. So what kind of struck me actually was there's actually quite a choice of really very good, strong Windows Phone devices, and of course one to suit all budgets. And if you don't like one particular brand, you do actually have a choice between, in theory, the HTC, the Lumia, and the Samsung, if you live in the States, that is. If you live anywhere else, you don't really have that choice at the moment. And I noticed that none of the kind of non-mainstream manufacturers, we've seen a whole bunch of them come out, everyone from Carbon to Spice to Yez, and many more others as well. Arcos was another one. But those are all low-end devices. And so they're not really, I feel, in the running for the sort of best Windows Phone of 2014. I think you possibly could give a shout out to the 535 or the 630 as being really outstanding value for money and getting an awful lot of the features, but it feels wrong kind of to choose a low-end phone as the standout one. I think it's a testament to the 830 in some ways that what is effectively a mid-tier device gets so close to all the others. And for that reason, I would actually pick out the best Windows Phone being the Lumia 830. I knew that question was coming inevitably. But if money is truly no object and the glance screen isn't a big deal for you, yes, I think the 930 is probably the device to choose. Interestingly, I would say the 1520 is probably the very best, particularly if you get a good price on it. You should be able to get a bit of a discount compared to the launch pricing, and varies from market to market. It's probably the one device that you look at and it's very, very difficult to pick out anything that's wrong with it. The problem is, of course, that its size will discount it for many people. You know, I love the fact that there's a great phablet device available now on Windows Phone, but that 6 inches is just going to be too big for most people. But other than that, it's probably the most perfect, in inverted commas, of the Windows Phone devices currently. I'm sort of wondering, Steve, I mean, you go back and forth all the time on devices, but if you had to pick out one, would it be the 930, or would you still plump for the 1020?
In my heart, I would still take the 1020 because it suits what I need a smartphone for so well. But I'm coming to the point now where, as I said in the article, I cannot discount the 930 any longer because it's got that more advanced Snapdragon 800 chipset, 2.2 gigahertz, 2 gig of RAM, and a camera that's small enough that it can be driven fast enough for the new software, yet large enough that it can still produce good quality, if that makes any sense. So I'm prepared to give the 930 another chance. So do watch out for a few 930 features before the end of the year on the site. I wanted to ask you, though, Ray, I mean, you've had a lot of hands-on with the HTC devices, and I'll come to the Samsung Ativa SE in a moment, but availability for the HTC M8 for Windows. I read something that there was going to be a world version that was going to come out, and I would have kind of expecting to see it in European markets by now, but you're saying it's still only available in the USA?
Yeah, it's now available as it was originally on Verizon. It's coming on to AT&T and T-Mobile, but we haven't had any information about a global launch. I don't think it's that HTC don't want to do it. It will be entirely down to operators, and if they haven't got the kind of operator willingness to support and launch it, it's not going to happen. I think part of the problem is, you know, with the European market, it's made up of more smaller markets, and so while collectively the European market is quite large, you would need to find one of the operators that operates in multiple markets and was willing to launch it. And I think the honest truth is that the Lumia devices kind of make up most of that European market. In the States, it just seems a bit more flexible. You know, you've got one bigger operator, and they kind of like having multiple manufacturers for each platform. That's always been a pattern there. It's ironic, given that Windows Phone is actually doing better in Europe. You know, it's about 10% of the devices being sold in the EU5. So, yeah, no, there's no actual news on that. And although there were, I think it's fair to say, rumours or at least information about it, nothing ever officially got announced about a world variant of the HTC One M8. And it sort of makes you wonder, it's probably too late now, to be honest, because it's not going to be all that long before we see the next generation HTC device and equally the next generation Lumia device. And It could probably still do okay. It'll be interesting to see how they positioned it, because I don't think there's going to be that massive a leap forward in sort of hardware chipset terms. We're kind of seeing variations on the Snapdragon 800, be it the 801 or the 805 or, you know, whatever comes next. So possibly it could still come, and I suppose it's possible we could see, presumably be the M9, see a Windows Phone edition of that if there's sufficient demand. Certainly there's been some speculation we'll see some of the other manufacturers jump back into Windows Phone as it starts to pick up, and particularly in the enterprise arena. But it's a device that really deserves more attention, because it really is a fantastic device. I mean, I know you like the Android version. I like the Android version. The Windows Phone version, it seems very strong as well. I mean, I will say that it doesn't have all the Lumia software on it, and that continues to be a disadvantage, even though some of that has now been made freely available, like Here Maps and Here Drive. There's still a lot of value in that Lumia software. We've been talking about the imaging stuff, but there's also various other ones, you know, things like the trailers application, just lots of little bits, and on their own, probably not enough to make a big difference. But by the time you add them all up and pick out the ones that you use regularly, you switch to a HTC, and the same would apply to a Samsung device, and it will feel like there's something missing if you've used a Lumia device before. If you're coming to Windows Phone for the first time, maybe not such a big deal. But it does feel like all that ancillary software that comes around with the Lumia something name on them actually is more significant than I kind of really appreciated. And so it's hard to recommend the HTC One M8 unless, you know, you really want to go for that form factor, that size. And actually, you know, no question, it's a really elegant design. And I love the dot view case. I think that's a really clever idea. It's going up against the 930, which feels a bit chubby, frankly, by comparison. In reality, that's probably a little unfair. It's just the way they feel in the hand. The build quality is excellent on both of them. And, you know, obviously aluminium plastic on the 930, aluminium unibody on the M8. So yeah, it's a tricky one, but it kind of makes me want to look forward to next year, because I'm hoping what we'll see is more competition for Lumia at the high end, and whether that's Sony coming back in, as has been rumored for a while, potentially even LG as well, or something else from HTC or Samsung. You know, it's really interesting, but it does feel like looking at all of these devices we've been talking about, Windows Phone is its strongest lineup of devices for quite some time now. We've said that about the low end for a while, but it also feels like that in the mid tier, maybe a bit of weakness on the high end. It would have been nice to see another flagship before Christmas. That's obviously not going to happen now. Probably have to look forward to MWC or the Windows 10 announcement. But that's kind of a long-winded answer to your rather short question, Steve. But you said the 1020 was your personal favorite. If you were recommending a Windows Phone device to someone, which one would it be?
I think it would have to be the 830, and I know that you've had that in relatively recently in your house in the last week or so. So presumably you can see why I was so enthusiastic about it. It really is the perfect sort of marriage of Windows Phone and a value for money hardware. And I know it's 280, which doesn't sound that much in the grand scheme of things, looking here at flagships, but that 280 is going to come down to about 230, 240. And at that price, you get an awful lot of smartphone for your money. So I would recommend the 830.
Yeah, I have to endorse that as well. I mean, unless you want to spend less money, in which case I'd suggest either wait a bit and get the 535. Well, actually, that's just coming onto the market in some places. Or look at the 630, which is, you know, around the £100 price point. The 735 is—it's difficult to recommend, because you sort of feel that if you're going to spend that, maybe wait and come up to the 830. But actually, that's a pretty big price jump. So all of those devices are good, but if you're just going to pick out one, that combination of features and value, I'm really blown away by the 830. I mean, I'd almost go so far as to say I think it's the best Windows Phone device we've ever seen. When you look at the overall picture, and this is taking into account cost, because, you know, obviously there are flagship devices that are more impressive in one way or the other. You know, the 1080p screen on the 930, for example, is better than the 720p screen you get on the 830. Well, Steve's going to tell me about Pentile and RGB. But okay, let's say the 1520 screen, which is, yeah, I think, probably still the benchmark on Windows Phone. And, you know, you look at something like the camera, and okay, it's a little bit down on the 20 megapixel module, but it's amazing how good it is, given that, you know, it obviously is a step down. And I was really surprised by that. And it's got things like microSD, the removable battery, which a lot of people do like. And it's got the Qi wireless charging. It's got the rich recording. It's got the 4G connectivity. It's got NFC. It's got pentaband. You know, all of those things that, you know, really make it stand out. And so I can't disagree with you. The 830, if you're just going to recommend one device to people, and honestly, what's so surprising about it in some ways is you could recommend that to someone who's used to using a high-end device. And honestly, I don't think they'd be that disappointed. If you recommend it to someone who's, you know, used to maybe a low-end device and is looking to spend a bit more, but maybe not flagship money, they're going to pick that up and they think they've got incredibly close to a flagship device. It really is very impressive. I mean, it got talked about as being the kind of the low-cost flagship or the mid-tier flagship. Honestly, it does live up to that label, the affordable flagship. It's a fantastic device, and I hope we see kind of iterations of that in the future. I really like the design, and I really like the kind of the combination of the value for money. It's a fantastic device. I've been really impressed in the week I've spent with it.
Yeah. And just a final thought before we finish the podcast. You could actually buy a Lumia 830, Rafe, and you could buy one for your partner, and you could buy one for your teenage kid. You could buy all three of them for less than the price of one iPhone 6 Plus.
That's right. On the other hand, you could go to the States, go and take part in the Black Friday sales and pick up a 630 for $35, which I guess is about £25, which means you could have 10 of them for the price of a 830 at the moment, or something like that.
Or 30 of them for the price of an iPhone 6 Plus. But we're going to get letters from iPhone owners, Ray, so we better stop. It's been fun chatting to you, Rafe, and the end of this All About Windows Phone Insight podcast. It's a goodbye from me. Any last words from Rafe?
Yeah, it's a goodbye from me as well. Thanks as ever to Steve for keeping me in line. Well, most of the time, I'll try to get him talking a little bit more next week. In fact, I know once Lumia camera comes out, finally, the real version, the big update, I will sit listening to Steve's wisdom about what I should be doing with the camera and all the great new features. But until then, goodbye from me as well, and thanks for listening.